Bristol Community FM. BCFM is the award-winning community radio station for Bristol, and it's here to give everybody in Bristol a voice. BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The Chinese government tells its navy to prepare for war, so where are the war clouds gathering and why? Disturbances too in Moscow after this week's Russian elections, but why has Rupert Murdoch's TV channel Fox News been sharing film of buildings on fire shot in Greece and saying it was shot in Moscow? As the profit motive wheedles its way into our hospitals, much to the delight of the American-style private healthcare industry, a Royal College of Nursing report out this week says the NHS whistleblowers have less protection now, even after the introduction of a new law supposedly to protect them. Plus, it's Human Rights Day tomorrow, so Will Stone from the Avon and Bristol Law Centres here again to explain if we really have any human rights, and if so, what they are. Plus, the good news of delays to the Coalition's cuts to legal aid. Then Mike Birkin is back from Bristol Friends of the Earth to explain how the Coalition government have clobbered Britain's solar power industry. But first, Martin Summers is here to discuss some of this week's international stories, and we're going to start, Martin, with this whole business of the Chinese telling their navy to prepare for war. What's that all about?
Well, frankly, the Chinese Navy is quite small. They just bought an aircraft carrier recently, and that's their very first one. The Americans have something like 30-something odd aircraft carriers, and nobody else has got more than two. So, I mean, people need to get a sense of proportion about this. I think the danger of war with China is more to do with what's happened in Pakistan this week. After the so-called assassination of Osama bin Laden some months ago, the Chinese gave a press conference where they'd given an ultimatum to the West. An ultimatum is a technical diplomatic term. It's the last thing you do before you go to war. And what they were saying is if you go into Pakistan again without clearing it with the Pakistani authorities, who are our allies, you're going to war with China. And the following day, Asif Zardari, who's the Prime Minister of Pakistan, flew to Beijing, and they gave a press conference saying that the Chinese were going to open a naval base at Gwalior on the Indian Ocean, right by the Straits of Hormuz. Now, also this week, the NATO attack on the 25 Pakistani soldiers that were killed in the two bases in Pakistan. I was reading an article by General Aslam Beg earlier, who used to be the head of the Pakistani army, and he said, as far as we're concerned, what was happening there, Takriti Talibani Pakistan, who are a jihadi group fighting the Pakistani military, had been trapped against the border by the Pakistani army, and then they called in a NATO airstrike in support, a NATO airstrike which went on for 2 hours using Apache gunships and tank busters, A-10 tank busters, and they killed 25 Pakistani soldiers, which led the Pakistanis to cut off all supplies going into Afghanistan for the NATO occupation forces. Now, I think what's most significant about that is that the former head of the Pakistani army is saying, look, you have got militants operating inside Pakistan, which you are giving air cover to. Now, this is a brink of war. No doubt about it. But Pakistan is prepared to stand up to the West because the Chinese will stand with them. And that is that the Chinese and the Russians are reaching the point where they don't trust the Americans at all. They basically abstained over the no-fly zone in Libya on the understanding that it was going to be a humanitarian operation. They feel tricked and fooled by that, and they're not going to be fooled again. And basically, they want peace, but they're getting fed up with the kind of attitude they're getting from Washington and from London. And basically, war is definitely on the cards. So people have got to recognise that.
You say that China has actually got a small navy, but where is their naval sphere influence then?
Well, they haven't got one. I mean, the US Navy is right up against the South, there's disputed that the Spratly Islands in the South China Sea are disputed between the Philippines and China, and the Americans are basically saying, you know, we're going to keep the Spratly Islands for the Filipinos. So the U.S. naval supremacy runs right up to Chinese territorial waters, and you can see that they're a bit fed up with this. That, you know, you've got the, I mean, what would they do if the Chinese did have a big navy and they were running their stuff right up to U.S. territorial waters? Incidentally, there is a Russian carrier battle group in the Caribbean, and also a Russian carrier and nuclear submarines and a whole carrier battle group in Syria in Tarsus. So we're moving towards a situation where a confrontation could take place.
It's a bit saber-rattling, isn't it? I mean, if they have hardly got a navy, I mean, there's a few islands that they're concerned about. I mean, surely all the Chinese are doing here is making a load of hot air over almost...
Well, I think their chances of catching up with the US in naval terms are pretty much zero. I think they would be foolish to even try.
I mean, in a day of aircraft and satellite technology, all these kind of missiles, I mean, is a navy actually... I mean, they were talking in the Second World War, in many ways, saying, well, because the Germans and I mean, actually, air power is what's important, not sea power, because aircraft can just take out...
Even more to the point, the Russians and the Chinese have been developing anti-ship missiles, which are cheap. Yeah, so your aircraft carrier, you've got, you know, the Ark Royal equivalents or whatever, they cost billions. These missiles cost millions, and they've got hundreds of them, and apparently they're really good, the SS-300s and so on. The Iranians have got all these missiles, and if they go to war with Iran, they need to pull back out of the Gulf. They've got loads and loads of ships in the Gulf, which are completely vulnerable to missile fire from the Iranians. So in order to attack them, they really need to withdraw from the Gulf. But if they do that, the Iranians will see the punch coming. Yeah, but I think the Iranian general staff's strategy here is, if we are attacked, then we're going to have a field day knocking out your aircraft carriers in the Gulf with our cheap missiles, and we'll take the punishment. You'll kill hundreds, perhaps thousands of our soldiers, but we'll kill thousands and thousands of yours, and it'll cost you a fortune. Of course, with the oil price going through the roof, that will crash the economy for sure, etc., etc. This is where we are. The banking system's teetering on the brink of collapse anyway, and these fools are throwing methane, methylated spirits on the bonfire. And it's a pretty appalling prospect, frankly.
Okay, well, let's go on to look at the Russian elections, and particularly this story to do with Fox News broadcasting pictures of the Greek violence as if they were the violence going on in Moscow. It sounds a little bit dodgy.
Well, they do it all the time, and Al Jazeera
Why do they do it? How are they on earth are they allowed to get away with showing news footage as if it's from one conflict when it's actually been manufactured from another conflict look worse?
Al Jazeera showed pictures of demonstrators in India pretending that they were demonstrators in Libya. You've got to remember that everybody uses, you know, a lot of media is propaganda. Fox News is definitely propaganda. And Al Jazeera, which has got quite a good reputation, was also involved because the Qatari army was fighting on the side of the rebels, of course.
Is it
that's
just
why.
A question of which propaganda you're watching at the moment, then?
Well, I think the point is, don't necessarily believe what you're being told by anyone. This whole thing of the Chinese threatening to go to war with us was covered extensively in the Pakistani media, extensively in the Indian media. Everybody knew about it, but we didn't know about it because nobody thought to tell us that the Chinese had just threatened to go to war with us, because it didn't fit the narrative. We just killed Osama bin Laden, hooray, isn't it great, what's going to happen for Obama's election chances? And they're not listening to somebody saying, no, because obviously the Chinese don't believe a word of what happened in Abbottabad. That was all right next to the Pakistani Sandhurst, and basically the Pakistani army is getting absolutely fed up of terrorism being run inside Pakistan by the Western intelligence services. So are the Iranians. We would be fed up if people were doing that to us. And at a certain point, people just say, well, we'd like to have peace, but we're just not going to get it, so we're going to have to teach you a lesson. And I think they will teach them a lesson, because they're actually arrogant and stupid.
So is it just total coincidence, then, that we're having this financial crisis at the same time as all this kind of military ramping up of talk of the potential of war?
I don't think so. I think they're very much related. I mean, a part of the problem, of course, is that we're spending far too much money on weaponry for years and years and years and years and years, which is why we've got no money left for anything else.
And do you think it's maybe to do with, if you're running out of options to deal with difficult situations at home, that actually it's helpful to distract everyone's attention by getting aggressive somewhere else?
It's the oldest trick in the book, and it's been pulled so many times, but it always works, doesn't it? Or it seems to. It's a tragedy and a disgrace, frankly, where the situation we've got ourselves into, and it's largely the fault of the financial and military elite in the West. The possibility of peace was definitely there from 1989 when the Berlin Wall came down and they fluffed it. It's a disgrace.
We've also heard from President Medvedev in the last few weeks of Russia that there are attempts to... he's been negotiating for quite a long time over this whole missile defence system, and he's recently come out with some criticism of that, really saying that if the West doesn't retreat from this missile defence system, that what they're doing is they're fueling a new arms race.
Well, they are. Are we going to listen to it, or
you just... Yeah, well, I mean, what are your thoughts on this missile defence system?
Well, I mean, it's provocative. I mean, it's absolutely provocative. Why do you want to stick a so-called missile defence system straight in the face of the Russians? The Russians draw the obvious conclusion that's directed at us. And they say, no, it's directed at the Iranians. They say, well, Iran's a long way away from here. And Putin, at one of these meetings they have, said, well, why don't we put this missile defence system in Azerbaijan? In fact, I've agreed with the guy who runs Azerbaijan that they're prepared to have it there. That's right next to Iran. Why don't you put it there? No, we want it in Poland.
Anyway, let's have a listen then to what President Medvedev had to say about all this last week.
Russia reserves the right to refrain from further steps in disarmament and arms control. In addition, considering the interrelation between strategic offensive weapons and defensive weapons, we may have grounds to withdraw from the New START treaty. This possibility is envisaged in the treaty. Nevertheless, I would like to stress once again that we are not closing the door for continuing the dialogue with the United States and NATO on missile defense. And for our practical cooperation in this area, we are prepared for that. However, for this work to be effective, we need clear legal framework for our cooperation, a framework that would take into account our legitimate interests. We are open for dialogue, and we expect reasonable and constructive approach on the part of our Western partners.
Yeah, that was President Medvedev speaking last week. Martin, just to sort of round up our look around the world, we've first heard about tension with China, even though they've got only a tiny navy. But the Russians are another ball game, aren't they?
They are, but I think their attitude is that, one of the things that struck me about this Russian election this week is nobody actually given us the proper results. I mean, I had to dig around on the internet. United Russia didn't do as well as they expected, but they still got the biggest, they were still the biggest party. The second biggest party on 19-20% was the Communist Party. And the West's little protégés, Nemtsov and his chums, they didn't even reach the 7% to get elected.
Protégés? So you reckon we've got Western...
Oh, there were Western protégés. The massive amounts of US money went into that Russian election to try and get their people elected and people they didn't want not elected. Can you imagine what the Americans would do if the Russians turned up in an American election with a massive war chest and gave it all to the people they were happy with? They would go bonkers. But of course the Americans think they've got the right to go into anybody else's country and pour money into the elections there in support of their own little protégés. But even with that support, they didn't get very far. And of course the real alternative to Putin is the Communist Party. In fact, if I was a Russian voter, I would have voted for the Communist Party. And ultimately they are best placed to remove Putin if he needs to be removed. And it's their business to sort it out, not anybody else's.
Now, finally then, on Iran, and you sent me a fascinating article midway through the week, the Covert Intelligence War Against Iran, which really documents what's been going on with the International Atomic Energy Authority, but something which I didn't know about, which was a whole succession of attacks, mysterious bomb explosions within Iran itself.
Yes, I mean, it's an open secret that the Western intelligence services are backing MEK, Mujahideen al-Haq. They're backing Jundullah, which is a Sunni separatist group in Balochistan. They're backing the PUK, which is a party of independent life in Kurdistan. So all of the armed opposition to the Iranian regime is being armed, trained, directed by Western intelligence.
And maybe
services.
I shouldn't say this, but you and I spoke to a British soldier, didn't we, that had said that he had actually been on a covert operation
inside Iran.
Inside Iran.
Exactly. Now, you can see why the Iranians might get a bit fed up with that, you know. And Ahmadinejad, despite what everybody says about him, and of course it's not a free society in Iran, they don't have properly free and fair elections, just like they don't have proper free and fair elections in Colombia, which is a pro-Western state. If you're standing for the wrong party, you can get killed. Nevertheless, independent observers said that he won the majority of the votes, so he's got political support inside the country, particularly in certain social groups, the urban poor and the rural poor. Now, ultimately, the West has got to stop bullying and start talking in a serious way, but they don't seem to be prepared to do that. The Iranians are also losing patience, and I think what will happen is that the Chinese and the Russians will fold their arms, let the Iranians kick the Western military forces around a bit, because I think they're quite capable of doing that. They're being very foolish if they think they're going to push the Iranians around, and the Americans and then the Chinese and the Russians will say to the West, did you like that? Because you can always have some more of that. And the military in China and Russia will be looking to see how their missile systems go. See if they're up to scratch. Because what the answer they've got to overwhelming US naval supremacy is anti-ship missiles, which are a hell of a lot cheaper. And if they can knock out a few aircraft carriers and so on with those, they'll be very happy with that.
Thanks very much, Martin. And we'll be hearing from Daphne Habercroft from Southwest Whistleblowers Health Action Group after this.
Got a letter from the government the other day. Opened it and read it. It said they were suckers. They wanted me for the army or whatever. Picture me giving a damn. I said never. It was a land that never gave a damn about a brother like myself. Cause I never did. I wasn't with her, but just that very minute it occurred to me that suckers had authority. Cold sweating as I dwell in myself. How long has it been? They got me sitting in a state pen. I gotta get up. I contemplated a plan on a cell floor. I'm not a fugitive on the run, but a brother like me began to be another one. But they're killing me serving time. They drew the line, yo. They criticized me for some
girls. Tricky there from 1995, a little bit more to go with that, maybe some other time, and that was Black Steel. So anyway, on now to talking about the National Health Service, and I'm joined by Daphne Habercroft. Hi Daphne, welcome to Drive Time.
Tony.
Now, first of all, I mean, you were in a few weeks ago, and since then I've seen that you've set up something called the Southwest Whistleblowers Act Health Action Group. What exactly is this? What's the purpose?
Well, what we were prompted by was really the unresolved concerns over the Bristol histopathology inquiry. And pathology is where people in laboratories analyse tissue to see if people have got cancer or not got cancer. And there were allegations that go back 10 years that doctors at North Bristol NHS Trust were finding errors in diagnoses made by pathologists at the BRI.
But when people are bound to make errors, aren't they? Everybody, even me, yes, I've made a few tonight.
Well, the issue with this is that these errors go back 10 years. There's some paediatric pathology misdiagnoses as well that have not been looked into. We go back to the old Bristol Royal Infirmary Heart Inquiry, and actually if you look at the recommendations of that and look at what happened with histopathology, it looks very much as if the lessons of the BRI Heart Inquiry were not learned. And you mention, yes, everybody makes mistakes, of course everybody does, but it's how you deal with those mistakes. And what's been going on in Bristol is that over the years the two NHS trusts in Bristol, the big two trusts, have got a history of rivalry and competing against each other, and there's been a lot of activity going on in centralising services for logical reasons to centralise expertise in the city. But what they didn't look at was how they were going to manage support services like pathology underneath that. And if you take the Bristol Royal Infirmary, they are set up as a tertiary referral centre for some diseases, which means that district general hospitals will refer complex cases to them for review, and therefore you should have pretty hot, top-notch pathology to be able to give correct diagnoses. And what the inquiry found out was that they weren't specialising sufficiently, pathologists were not getting involved in external quality assurance. And so, as well as some basic not being able to diagnose cancers from benign conditions and vice versa, they don't seem to have been set up to have looked at complex cases. And so the inquiry, their report, comments on this, that they weren't specialising, but nobody looked at the reasons why that had been allowed to go on for so many years. And that's one of the reasons we set ourselves up.
Now, one of the purposes is you're one of the ports of call potentially for whistleblowers, people who see working within the health service, or at least a witness to what's going on within the health service, including family members of patients, for example. And so what's the purpose of that then? You're just another place that people can come to? Because, I mean, this is, we've had a law, apparently, I didn't know anything about this, but apparently, according to the Royal College of Nursing, a special NHS whistleblowers law, or a whistleblowers law that certainly applies to NHS employees, so that should surely be adequate.
No, well, the old Public Interest Disclosure Act, which I think was kicked off in 1998, was supposed to protect whistleblowers, and it hasn't. And there isn't a week goes by when you don't open a newspaper and find out that whistleblowers have been persecuted, people have tried to raise concerns and they haven't been able to. And the big example that's been going on this year is the Mid Staffordshire Public Inquiry. So whistleblowers have not been protected, and they're still not being protected, and there's a number of reasons for it.
Well, in The Independent this week, Jeremy Lawrence, who's the health editor, had an article, "The NHS whistleblowing safeguards are not working," he said. "Efforts to encourage whistleblowing, exposing abuse, neglect and poor care in the NHS are falling on deaf ears. In October, the government announced changes to the NHS constitution to ensure staff who raise concerns about patient care would be protected. The changes also made it clear it was the duty of NHS staff to report bad practice or mistreatment, but a survey of, and here comes the point, 3,000 members of the Royal College of Nursing published today found nurses were more reluctant to report concerns and managers were less likely to act on them than in a similar survey conducted 2 years ago. And this article goes on to say the report expected to expose a culture of bullying in the NHS as well as failures in regulators is due to be published next year. Peter Carter, Chief Executive of the Royal College of Nursing, said it's extremely worrying that nurses are being explicitly told not to raise concerns. After all, we've learnt about the consequences when problems are not tackled. Cases such as the terrible situation that arose at Stafford Hospital should be adequate warning about the consequences of slashing staffing levels and ignoring staff concerns. The problems over staffing had widened the gulf, he said, between the rhetoric and reality over protecting those who spoke up. So, I mean, this is we're hearing words that whistleblowers are protected, but there is clear evidence here that they're not. And this is not only practical evidence, but it's also a big survey of 3,000 staff in the NHS who say they're now more afraid to speak up when they see things going wrong.
Yeah, well, we've seen in Bristol with the Bristol histopathology concerns that doctors tried to raise concerns for a number of years and were not taken seriously. And their concerns still haven't been taken seriously, even though the BRI spent over £720,000 on an inquiry. But we think there's a number of reasons why whistleblowers are not being protected. Firstly, there is no doubt the NHS is a bullying culture. It's also a monopoly employer. So if you upset your local NHS management, you're going to find it very difficult to get a job elsewhere in the country in the NHS. We know staff are scared. We've got evidence that doctors in Bristol have been scared over raising concerns over the pathology problems. We've got that in writing. There's also money, because medical directors, a lot of doctors rely on medical directors to nominate them for clinical excellence awards, and these awards can be worth a lot of money to doctors. For example, consultants, if they get clinical excellence awards, which are for showing that they deliver high quality services and are improving services, their awards can range from about £3,000 a year to £76,000 a year for top national awards. These awards are given every year, so if they get an award one year, they'll get the same amount next year, and it all counts towards their final salary. So if you've got a medical director who doesn't want you to rock the boat on problems in his hospital because they're going for foundation trust status, they want to bring in more revenue from people commissioning their services, then the medical directors have got an easy carrot and stick mechanism to keep their doctors in line. So you threaten them with not giving them their clinical excellence award, you threaten them with sacking them, and it's very easy to manipulate people in that way.
So definitely, it certainly is really concerning, especially since there's so many changes going on right now in the National Health Service, what with the North Bristol Trust also now becoming a foundation. How do people contact you, and if people feel that they would rather talk to you rather than possibly go to their manager, what can they do? That by email, by phone, and how can they do that and be ensured of some kind of confidentiality?
Yeah, well, we've got a website, so if people just go on to Google and
or their other favourite search engine,
any of their favourite search engines, they can just put in SWWHAG, put that in, and then our website will pop up, and we've got our contact details there.
And do you have email and a phone number? Because not everybody's got the internet. So is there a phone number?
Yes, but I can't remember it at the moment.
Well, maybe we could do that at the end of the programme. Yeah. It for the South West Whistleblowers Health Action Group, and Daphne Havercroft. Well, Daphne, thanks ever so much for joining us today. Martin, maybe we could just finish by talking to you about this, because it is quite really concerning. Why is it that, do you think, I mean, having heard this report from the Royal College of Nursing, that actually nurses are actually more afraid now to report malpractice when they see it than they were a couple of years ago?
Well, I mean, they would have to speak for themselves about that. I'm not a nurse, so I don't really know. But I would say that what I picked up from what Daphne was saying is that the foundation trust status and the kind of competition between different hospitals does lead to a situation where they don't want bad publicity, and they're more interested in keeping their publicity good than in getting problems resolved. I mean, that's what I was hearing. And I think that, a publicly run service is a monopoly, as Daphne also pointed out, and therefore there's got to be checks and balances in there to make sure it's done properly, and it's got to be ultimately patient care that counts, and not to balance in the books.
Ensures my insanity. Passing the ignorance ensures the struggle. struggle for my family. We're hungry, beware of our appetite. Doing drugs from the news never kill tonight. The kill which I share is my passages. We take our fill, take our fill, take our fill. I stand firm for our soil. Look where I come from. The juicy, the juicy. Dressing up in sissy. Confused by different memories. Details of Asian remembrances. Conversations. I want to become a venom. My brain thinks bomb-like. So I listen, he's the conkite. As I grow, and as I grow collective. Before the move, sit on the perspective. Mr. Quail in the crevice, and waters from the precipice. Imperial passage. Heat from the sun, someday slowly passes. Until then, you have to live with yourself. Until then, you have to live with yourself.
Yes, homegrown group there, Tricky Again from the mid-1990s. And I'm just going to find what that one is called. Hell is Round, allegedly, according to them anyway. Now I'm joined by Will Stone from the Avon and Bristol Law Centre. Hi, Will, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony.
Now, you're concentrating today on the human rights, because tomorrow is Human Rights Day, allegedly.
That's right, Tony. Yep.
Now, what is the Human Rights Day all about, though?
The Human Rights Day, which is the 10th of December every year, commemorates the founding of the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, which tomorrow is 63 years old.
Okay, and it's included in that declaration, I seem to remember, is the right to shelter, and yet we have lots and lots of people sleeping on our streets and sleep in the city. So this is one of the reasons I love talking about human rights. I want to know, do they actually mean anything?
They do mean something. They mean quite a lot. We've got the Human Rights Act in the UK. We've had it for 12 years. Certain members of the current government are looking to see it abolished. It's important because of what I will refer to as the Heineken effect, which is that it reaches the parts other laws fail to reach. So every law in this country, every decision that's taken by any public authority has to have regard to the 14 basic rights that are set out in the Human Rights Act, which were originally set up in the United Nations Declaration 63 years ago.
So we've got 14 basic rights. Can you tell us what they are?
I can run through them.
Yep.
There's the right to life, the right to freedom from torture and degrading treatment, the right to freedom from slavery, the right to liberty, the right to a fair trial, to no punishment without law, to private and family life, which I think comes into what you were talking about, the right to shelter, the freedom of thought, the freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, the right to marry and have a family, the right to an education, the right to free elections, and the prohibition of discrimination.
What about things like this right to education? There's a lot of young people right now thinking, well, hang on a minute, I actually cannot afford to get my my higher education, even though they could quite possibly be they've got the qualifications but just can't afford to do it. So how do difficult little knotty ones like that fit into human rights?
Well, any kind of decision that's taken by a public authority, and that may even include a government, has to take account of those 14 basic rights. So challenges can be made to decisions that are made by public authorities, including the government, any public authorities, to say that that breaches the rights that are set out in the Human Rights Act. And that has been done, and that has been done with quite success on a number of occasions.
So is there anywhere, one sort of central point you can come and find out where your rights are? I mean, for example, at your law centre, do you have a leaflet about human rights where all those rights are listed, so we know when a public authority is doing something it shouldn't be?
Well, you can go onto certain websites to find out those sort of details. You can go to the Equality and Human Rights Commission. Unfortunately, the Law Centre doesn't have the resources to provide leaflets, although we can get that information and we can pass it on to people. We can download it, we can print it off. You can come to the Law Centre. The Law Centre is open 5 days a week. We currently have a legal aid contract in public law, which includes human rights. We can challenge those decisions. For example, freedom from torture and degrading treatment. Just whilst we were off air, Martin and I were talking about certain day centres being closed for elderly people. That may result in challenges that can be taken under the Human Rights Act.
Now, you mentioned legal aid there, and it was interesting. I mean, it passed me by. I think it was last Thursday, not Thursday just gone, the Thursday before. It was actually announced that the legal aid cuts, the £350 million of cuts, there was going to be a 6-month delay to it. So do you think this is partly due to lobbying of people like you?
I think it certainly has. There's been, thanks to a lot of the lobbying that's done, a lot of the public campaign, the House of Lords got very uptight about a lot of the changes that were due to be made. Due to criticisms that were made by the House of Lords, the government has now put all the changes off until April 2013.
And so what's the nub of the issue? Because they're clearly trying to save money. Why shouldn't they be saving money in this particular area?
In
legal aid, in the legal aid changes that they were trying to put through. I mean, what is it that you think that's won over the Department of Justice to bring about this delay?
I think because certainly a lot of the House of Lords believe that this is taking things a step too far, that people need access to justice. It's certainly a right, and it's regarded as a human right, and access to justice is very important. And if you can't protect those basic rights, then what is the point in having them? It shouldn't be the case where if you can only use the law if you can afford to do so, and I think that's been recognised by the Lords.
Just quoting from an example in this article in The Guardian, the headline is Kenneth Clark delays £350 million legal aid cuts. Lord Wilson, it says in the article, the newest appointment to the Supreme Court, and Sir Nicholas Wall, President of the Family Division, publicly joined those urging the government to rethink its proposals, branding them a false economy and an impediment to swift justice. Well, one can see how it might be an impediment to swift justice, but why is it a false economy?
Well, it's a false economy because, for example, if you take the right to home, the right to have a home, if you cannot enforce certain rights in the court. Let's say you're about to be evicted because of rent arrears through no fault of your own. Perhaps you haven't been able to get the housing benefit through because the local authority just hasn't managed to get the decision through. You find yourself on the street. You go to the local authority. The local authority then have to spend extra money either rehousing you or putting you in temporary accommodation or paying for the advice that you've got to have. If that doesn't happen, you end up on the street. You get ill, you end up in the hospital, it ends up costing the health service an awful lot of money. So that's why it's a false economy.
There's been a lot of stories, particularly in the Daily Mail, about the Human Rights Act. So hasn't it resulted in some very unpopular decisions, you know, where the Human Rights Act is employed, for example, to stop someone being deported who is a criminal and should be deported?
A lot of that is wrong. I mean, for example, Theresa May's story about the cat Maya the cat, I found out today in my research. Of course, that was a myth. It was the cat was nothing to do with the decision. The decision was part of Home Office policy. And if you actually look into a lot of the decisions that make the headlines of the Daily Mail, you find that they're not actually quite what they're said there are.
But it wasn't just the Daily Mail on that occasion. It was actually one of the centrepiece arguments of the entire Conservative Party conference.
And it was wrong, and it's been recognised as wrong, and I think an awful lot of commentators from a lot of other newspapers have actually pointed out that it was wrong. Even the Home Office, even Kenneth Clark, the Minister of Justice, actually pointed out that it was wrong. So, I mean, I don't think there's anything controversial about that. But, of course, the cases that get to the headlines are the extreme end. They're the ones that get to court. They're the difficult cases. What you don't hear about are the cases that have been won under the Human Rights Act, which didn't make the headlines. For example, issues around degrading treatment. I mean, the recent care home case in Bristol, where that was clearly a case that would have been taken under the Human Rights Act if it hadn't happened. Interestingly, I found out today again in my research that the junk mail opt-out that you now have when you sign on to the electoral register, that was a result of a challenge that was made against a local authority under the Human Rights Act.
Okay, now what's wrong with the idea of a UK Bill of Rights? Because, I mean, essentially that's what, isn't it, what Jack Straw did when he introduced the Human Rights Act into British law?
Absolutely right, and that's why we don't need it. The Human Rights Act is already there. We don't need a separate Bill of Rights. If the Human Rights Act was abolished and something, let's call it a Bill of Rights, was put in place, that Bill of Rights would still be bound by the UN and the European conventions. If it wasn't compliant, then that would mean that all the cases that were taken under it would end up in Europe, which of course would end up costing far more to the UK taxpayer. It's British citizens really should be proud of the fact that the UK is a leader on human rights on this one, and should celebrate that, not denigrate that. The UK is and should be an example and should be proud of that.
Well, Will, the whole business of the delay to the Human Rights Bill, I mean, surely this is just simply lawyers, I mean, people like yourself, actually just simply lobbying to try and keep their income. It's not a matter of principle from your point of view. Surely you're just looking for to keep that income stream up. And in a way, that's kind of selfish, isn't it?
Well, if you abolish the Human Rights Act and replace it with something else, then the lawyers will in fact make more money because they'll be taking cases to Europe, which will involve them having to go to Strasbourg and the travel costs and the extra costs for high-paid lawyers that would come with that. So I don't think if that really happens. Keeping things in Britain means it's a lot cheaper. It means lawyers get a little less money, but it's a lot cheaper for the UK taxpayer.
Well, it's nice to hear we do have some real human rights. Lovely to hear. Martin, what's your take on all this? Because obviously, actually bringing the human rights into British law right across the board has made quite a difference, hasn't it?
Well, I wouldn't know as much as our guest here. I do understand, perhaps you can enlighten me on this, because I think the Human Rights Act is not directly related to the EU, is it? It's related to other European treaties, like the... it's not. Is it a European Union thing, or is it something to do with the... you know, because I remember Eastern European countries when they were acceding to, you know, they had to fulfil certain obligations under the OSCE and things of that sort. So it's not actually a Brussels thing, or am I wrong?
Well, there is the European Convention on Human Rights, which is incorporated into the European Treaty, which, because of that, is incorporated into the sovereign law of every single country, and means that any law or any decision that's taken within any of the EU countries, if it's not compliant under the EU Convention on Human Rights, can be challenged. That one has to be challenged, of course, in Strasbourg, if there is no national law in place. The Human Rights Act is that national law, which means that we don't have to take every case to Strasbourg.
So we've got lots of, that. We've actually got quite a lot of human rights. I wonder, just to wrap up, Will. Yes, Will. I mean, so long as they don't take away legal aid, you will have access to the law as well. So, Will, can you just run through your list, the original list, just to remind us what our human rights are? Because I think it's quite important to do that for our Human Rights Day tomorrow.
Well, there's the basic right to life. There's the right to freedom from torture and degrading treatment. The right to freedom from slavery. The right to liberty. The right to a fair trial. To no punishment without due law, the right to private and family life, the right to freedom of thought, freedom of expression and freedom of assembly, the right to marry and to have a family, the right to an education, the right to free elections and the prohibition of discrimination. And if people are interested, there's a meeting tomorrow at Newton Hall, Newton Street, called Human Rights Detention Wrong. It's organised by the Bristol Refugee Rights. That's at 6 o'clock tomorrow at Newton Hall in Newton Street in Easton. And from 7:30, they're going to have a fundraising party.
Lovely, sounds great. Will, can you just remind us whereabouts the Avon and Bristol Law Centre is and what your opening times?
Avon and Bristol Law Centre is in Stokes Croft. We're open Monday to Friday, basically from 10 o'clock to 4 o'clock, although we are closed on Wednesday and Friday afternoon. You can catch us on our webpage, which is www.ablc.org.uk, or ring us on Bristol 924 8662.
Well, Will Stone from Avon and Bristol Law Centre, glad to see you're recovering. I know you had a bit of a cold this week. Thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time this evening.
Thank you, Tony.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Now I'm joined by Mike Birkin from South West Friends of the Earth. Hi, Mike.
Good
welcome
evening,
to
Tony.
Drive Time. You've come in today to talk a bit about the whole business of solar power. And as I announced it at the beginning of the hour, and I did a little bit of research on this, it looks like Britain's solar power industry has got it in the neck, really, because they were planning for quite a big expansion, and now it looks like that expansion isn't going to happen due to some changes.
The expansion has already happened. There's been a massive increase in the number of people working in the solar industry, the amount of solar panels installed on people's roofs. Basically, over the last year, there are now 30,000 people working in the solar industry, and it's been a success story. And the underlying factor has been the government's introduction of a system that operates in many European countries now. It's called a feed-in tariff, where the householder gets a guaranteed income from the electricity they generate from their roof over a period of 25 years. So it's a big incentive for people to pay the money up front to get a solar panel installed.
Sounds like a fantastic idea. It means that if you've got all of your your little red lights on your TV and all that switched off during the day, your solar panel, especially on a nice sunny day, you're actually earning money from those solar panels by selling that electricity into the grid. Fantastic.
You're earning money anyway, and you're also getting the benefit of reducing your own electricity bills. Now, what's happened is things that really could have been foreseen. One of the first things that happened was that people started taking advantage of this by building simply massive arrays of solar panels on farmland. And then also that a number of companies have set up what they call rent-a-roof schemes, basically. So they just come across, knock on your door and say, you know, let us put a solar panel on your roof. You get the cheap electricity and we get the tariff. And that has meant huge amounts of money going into the hands of a few companies. And that's underlain this enormous boom. So the government has now sort of peremptorily acted and said, right, okay, we're going to axe the tariff. We're not going to cut it off entirely, but we're going to cut it in half.
Well, it sounds like, in a way, that's a sensible thing to do, because this was never really the idea, was it, that some companies would set up to sort of almost hijack people's roofs to use this. It's much better, you know, from a fairness point of view, that it's your own roof that you're actually managing to earn a little bit of a living from.
I think the underlying argument there, Tony, is not unfair, but what our real gripe is that the way the government has done it, we're next to no note. They actually announced they're having a consultation which ends on December the 23rd, but they're bringing in the changes to reduce the tariff from December the 12th. So they're not even waiting to hear what the outcome of the consultation is before they act and slash these tariffs in half, with next to no notice for the industry. So it's thrown this thriving, you know, burgeoning new industry, which is employing a lot of people, absolutely into turmoil.
I mean, surely, and most of these solar panels, they're not even made in Britain, are they? Surely most of them are made abroad.
Some are made in Wales, otherwise they come from Germany or from China. But I mean, that's part of the reason why we want to encourage a solar industry here in Britain, is that we can start building the manufacturing capacity here once that industry gets established. The thing that is particularly galling about this is that a number of not private operators, but local authorities, housing associations, community interest companies have been working, using this tariff to establish community schemes or not-for-profit schemes which benefit the poorer householders and allow them to do things like tackle fuel poverty through insulation at the same time as installing solar panels. These things have been much more complicated to put together. You have to it requires bringing in finance from a number of sources, which is quite difficult to arrange, and these are the schemes that are just beginning to get off the ground, and smack, you know, the government has really cut their legs out from under them. So it's a lot of people have spent a lot of time over this year putting together social schemes for social benefit that take advantage of this feed-in tariff, and have now had to stop that work completely.
Well, that sounds really unfair to me, because people have laid out on the promise of a programme, and then that programme, just as they've splashed out on this, has been pulled out from underneath, and it doesn't sound really very fair. It's the sort of thing I imagine the people on College Green would be getting annoyed about.
It's pretty inept, and it shows a lack of foresight on behalf of the civil servants who designed this scheme. It shows a lack of concern, really, for the real consequences. So a lot of schemes are now having to be sort of patched back together again. Where we've been pushing the government strongly, I'm sort of hot from visiting a local MP just this afternoon, to really say that you have to set up a scheme that allows these community, not-for-profit, local authority, housing association type schemes that use a feed-in tariff. You have to give them preferential treatment and make sure that they really do have the guarantee, because it's difficult to set those schemes up.
Martin Summers, what are your thoughts on this? Because energy policy is massively important. We talk about it very regularly on here. We've got the prospect looming of two nuclear power stations which will virtually bypass the planning process, appearing upwind of here, at Hinkley and one at Barclay. So what are your thoughts about what Mike's been telling us about this change to the solar power?
Well, obviously, I mean, I'm just responding to what I've been hearing. It obviously does require a bit of tweaking, because it was the wrong people were getting the subsidy. But that's no excuse for just getting rid of the subsidy, which was there for a very good reason, to establish a solar power industry in Britain.
Isn't it fairly simple just to say, well, you can only get the subsidy if it's your own roof?
Well, yes, you'd have thought something like that could have been thought about.
It doesn't sound
that complicated to come up with that. But of course, we had John Rogers on here earlier, and he was saying that, well, perhaps what we need is a green revolution, if you like, let's massively skill up our people to do this stuff. Let's go from 100% solar power, 100% insulation. Why not? That's the way you break the back of a depression recession. You have a good idea of things you want to do, and you set off and you do it, and you put people to work. Young people particularly can be trained up. It's a perfectly logical thing to do. But the government basically are, you know, they're fiddling around, aren't they?
I sniff here a little smell of possibly the vested interests in the energy industry that don't want to see this take off.
There's no doubt that some of the big six energy companies did lobby against that feed-in tariff quite vigorously, because they don't want to see households becoming independent of them for their electricity supply. So, yeah, there is that big business connection there pulling the strings somewhere.
Martin, what do you see for the future? Because we've been talking, as I said before, quite a lot about, you know, our energy, the energy spread, whereabouts we get our energy from, which kinds of power generation. Surely solar is one of the most important answers, isn't it?
Well, I would think so. One of the other big important answers is energy conservation. I remember reproducing a report by Amory Lovins from the Rocky Mountain Institute in the 1990s, pointing out that the real savings has been made in energy conservation. So instead of figuring out where are we going to get all the electricity from, think about designing things that don't need loads of electricity but still function. And that's all a technology that's perfectly well understood. Nothing clever or fancy about it. You just need to put your mind to it and make sure the standards are there. So in Germany, for example, all new houses have to reach pretty high standards for energy conservation, whereas ours are basically cowboy standards like most of the other things in this country.
But I mean, in a way, this is a kind of kick in the teeth, isn't it, for people who have invested in solar, Mike?
Well, yes, it is. I mean, and that's why a lot of people are angry about it, and why we are pushing the government really hard now to, firstly, to delay the introduction of this new tariff so it doesn't take effect as of next week, but also to really consider how the tariff is going to... They're not axing it completely, they're just, you know, it's the way they've done it. So it's right that it should come down because the cost of solar panels is coming down. It's been successful. It costs probably 30% less now to install a solar panel than it did a couple of years ago, simply because we've got the volume, we've got that industry going. So the tariff should come down accordingly. That's fine, but just kind of without warning, you fall off a cliff. That is not the way to adjust a payment to allow a company, an industry to develop.
Quite right. And also, we've had some Bristol campaigners involved recently in this this fracking. So actually, a protest action against fracking. I mean, we've discussed it several times. Can you just remind us what fracking is?
Yeah, it's a way of extracting what is basically conventional natural gas from within rock formations deep underground, which wouldn't be accessible by normal means, and it involves injecting chemicals and kind of making some small explosions underground, so you actually force open the strata and allow the natural gas to come to the surface. Now there are sort of, you know, strong concerns about what this might do to a water table or even to the geological stability. There were earthquakes recorded after they did the fracking in Lancashire, but I think more to the point is it's a massive blind alley in terms of our future energy investment. We've already got enough fossil fuels coming on stream that we can recover economically that are going to fry the planet, so why are we pushing to develop more?
And the protest group involved is called Frack Off, apparently, and these are the people who
put it better myself.
Many of the people who actually were arrested recently up north somewhere. Do you know exactly where?
Well, it's near Blackpool, the Lancashire area, where the initial trials, a company called Quadrilla, have been actually doing the fracking, but the government is about to license potentially a whole lot of new areas, which could include large chunks of the southwest. And there are rumours that a company is going to put in an application on the Mendips.
Well, the campaign group is Frack Off. So, Mike Birkin from Southwest Friends of the Earth, can you just finish off by giving us your phone number and telling us where your group meets?
Yep, sure. We haven't got a January meeting fixed up yet, but you can contact us on our website, www.bristolfo.org, and you can phone me on Bristol 942 0128.
Well, Mike Birkin from Southwest Friends of the Earth, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, that's the serious talk pretty much out of the way this evening. But before we go, I do must remind you of, Daphne has dug out the number for Southwest Whistleblowers Health Action Group. The phone number is 07971 968244. That's 07971 968244. The website for the Whistleblowers Action Group for the NHS is www.swhag.wordpress.com, and if you want to contact them on email, it's swwhistleblowers@gmail.com. So that's all for this week. Fresh Blood Party up next. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Lib Dem Cabinet Member for Care and Health. And also thanks to Mike Birkin, Daphne Habercroft, and to Will Stone. We'll see you next week. We're online at...